I used to get really frustrated in pro-ams because I'd get guys and I'd be trying to coach them in the pro-am. And I'm getting annoyed because, you know, I tell them, look, you know, if you spend 20 minutes on your short game, you're going to knock 5 shots off your handicap. Just do this and you're done. And, you know, they wouldn't do it. You could see it. Yeah. They weren't interested. So after a while, I figured out there's two types of people who play golf. There's the person who wants to win a competition. And they're happy to play badly, have a great short game, and get the ball up and down and shoot a good score. They work on getting their handicap down, all that thing. But the vast majority of golfers, and I think it's close to 90%, would prefer to hit the golf ball really well and never win a competition ever again.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks so much for joining us. Very excited about our guest today, none other than Padraig Harrington. Multiple major championship winning Padraig Harrington coming to us from Dublin, Ireland. Padraig is wonderful to listen to, a great storyteller. We get into his life before golf, his life after golf. He almost became an accountant instead of a major champion, which is pretty wild. We'll get into that. We'll also get a lot of tips. This is a very useful podcast because Padraig is very generous in sharing tips that I'm sure there's something in here that's going to help your game. And it's going to be good for your travel as well, because we're going to get into Irish links and planning an Irish links trip and all that good stuff. So thanks for tuning in. First, though, in case you haven't noticed, it is November. It's November already. It's kind of crazy for any number of reasons, not least of which is that that means that holiday shopping season is upon us yet again. So if you are a regular listener to this show, then you know that this podcast and the Golfers Journal are member supported. They're both made possible. Everything we do at the Golfers Journal made possible by our members. But that's not why I think the Golfers Journal is such a great holiday gift. I think it's a great holiday gift because there's nothing like the experience of the Golfers Journal, nothing quite like it in golf. The print experience where you hold something in your hand with great photography, great writing, with its great construction. I think it's a great gift because you become a member of something. You become part of a global network of golfers that love the game like you do, and a community in which you can find a local game really wherever you are in the world. As a member, you're going to get this, you're going to get a member locker that's going to be filled with thousands of dollars in potential savings from companies like Bushnell, Arcos, AG1, Linksoul, The Short Game Chef, and many, many more. And just by signing up, you'll receive invites to the entire 2024 event schedule, which is, I must say, I've seen it. It's pretty incredible. I'm very excited to share it with everyone and to do that preview show when we do that, hopefully soon in the new year. But we did just drop two more 2024 events. So just to let you know that we're going to Cabot Citrus Farms, which is the new Cabot Outpost in Florida. That's everyone's very excited about, a lot of buzz around that. And the 4-day trip to Punta Mita in Mexico, the Punta Mita Resort. I'm not missing that one this time. I've seen the pictures of the whale tail, the par 3 that's out in the ocean. I have so much FOMO looking at those pictures of all the fun that's been had there in the past. So I hope I get to make it this year. I hope you get to make it. Find out more information about all our events at golfersjournal.com/events. So as you can see, there's a lot of value that comes along with becoming a member. And of course, by becoming a member along the way, you're directly helping us add even more value. So thank you. And thanks for supporting the Golfers Journal. While we're talking about holiday shopping and holiday gifts, what goes better next to the Golfers Journal when it comes to gifts? Nothing goes better than the new TSR driver from Titleist, because this thing, it goes forever. It sounds great. It feels great. You've seen players over all the professional tours playing the TSR. I mean, Titleist has made huge jumps in the driver game in recent years, and the technology in the TSR is absolutely second to none. So pick up some speed for the holidays by setting up a fitting for yourself or for a loved one at Titleist.com today. Now let's turn things over to Padraig, who I do find myself calling Paddy here. It's kind of, which I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but in any event, he has Paddy's golf tips on YouTube. So I do slip into that. And the tips are very, again, they're good. And you're going to hear why Padraig was right when he said that after this recording, I was going to go directly to the driving range, because I absolutely did, because his tip for me, it was spot on. Where are you, Padraig?
I am at home in Ireland, so in Dublin, sitting in my office.
Now, where in Dublin?
A place called Rathmichael, so near Bray.
Near Bray?
Yeah, so be near Woodbrook Golf Club, very near Woodbrook Golf Club.
That's a lovely spot. Yeah, I've played there. That's a really good one. I've spent a little time in Bray, and then, you know, played down through Wicklow and down the southeast. And was just down at the European Club this summer. Hopefully some of our listeners have had the chance to join the European Club south of Dublin, a really, really special spot. And we're going to want to ask you about your special spots in Irish golf. Let's start with, all right, the pronunciation of your name, Padraig. Now, when I'm in Ireland, why do people drop the D and go Porrig? Is that, am I doing it right or wrong?
It'd be a more popular version, Porrig, in Ireland, for Porrig. Sure. Okay. But my mother always puts the D in Padraig, so it's Padraig to me, and I would stick with Padraig. It does cause a bit more confusion, so that's why I go with Paddy in the States.
Well, there you go. So if you hear Porrig, it's not like, that's what an Irish person is referring to. And that would mean, you know, talking about your family and growing up in Ireland, having a name like Padraig, your brothers have Irish names as well. Your dad played for Cork, Gaelic football, I believe. So what role did, you know, Irish culture and the Irish games play in your upbringing?
I think the Irish games, I played Gaelic football and hurling. My dad was a top class Gaelic footballer. I actually thought my sporting career would have been in Gaelic football. I captained my high school team, that sort of level.
Wow.
But I got good at golf and started switching my allegiance from all those different sports. I played a bit of soccer as well. Towards golf because I was successful. I think I did like golf, but I also liked the team sports. I liked everything I did. Yeah. So I do think it was the success and maybe the fact that I was in control of the success with golf. Whereas when you're playing team sports, I was a goalkeeper for some of those teams. So oftentimes when we lose, it's my fault. And when we win, it's got nothing to do with me. So it's a miserable... There's a lot of golfers who are goalkeepers. It seems... I think... Goalkeepers have a certain personality, and maybe that lends itself well to golf as well. You know, you there's a lot of ups and downs in being a goalkeeper. There's a lot of responsibility in it. It kind of mirrors being out there on your own on a golf course.
Do you think that would that be a way to describe your personality? You know, being, you know, because it takes a certain personality to be able to handle it all being on you, all the time one spends alone. Does that suit you? Well, yeah, you're pretty good at
I like responsibility.
Yeah.
I like that end of it. I like being in control and having responsibility. And, you know, if you looked at, I'm 25 years at Wilson. I've had the same manager for my whole pro career.
Yeah.
So that's like close to 26 years. I probably used 3 or 4 putters in my whole life on tour. So everything that I'm not somebody that misses a putt and goes, it's the putter's fault. If I miss a putt, it's my fault.
Yeah.
So it's the same with everything else. I think I like to be in control. To be in control so that I have responsibility that if something's not working, I blame myself and go and work on it and figure it out. There are golfers who do it different though. So, you know, I think as a young man, I thought there was only one way to do everything. As you get older, you realize plenty of people are successful doing it different ways. But I kind of coined this phrase, you know, everything works once. But not everything works all the time. So you can do the wrong thing and get away with it and think it's right. And you can do the right thing and it fail and think it's wrong. You know, ultimately, you've got to choose doing the right thing because it would be more successful more often. So when you see people get angry and lose their temper on the golf course, you know, maybe break a club, oftentimes you see them make a birdie. They get away with it. So they keep being angry. Whereas if they double bogey the next hole, there's a price to pay. I would have seen it too with when I was growing up with kids. I know this is a different culture than the US, you know, kids who would have, I'm talking young adults who would have drank. And, you know, they might practice all winter and get to a big championship and then they go out and party and drink. And of course, the worst thing that can happen if you've had a drink is you go out and shoot a good score the next day. Because for the rest of your life, you'll think, you know what, I could get away with this. Whereas if you came out and shot 80 the next day after having a drink, you go, well, the next time you want to drink, you go, do I want to drink? There's a penalty for drinking. There's a cost to drinking. You might go out and party. I'm not telling somebody not to go out and party. I'm just saying that if there's a penalty, you'll choose wisely. And sometimes you will. And most of the time you won't.
Padraig, I know that lesson all too well as a former, a no longer drinker myself. Actually, and I wanted to ask you about that. It's my understanding that you don't drink. Were you a pioneer?
I actually do drink. I just don't drink.
Oh, okay.
I don't need to have a drink to sit and chat. I wouldn't need to have a drink in the evening time with a meal. But socially, yeah, if I was at a wedding, I'd need to have a drink. I wouldn't be great at getting on the dance floor. So if I win a tournament, I would have a drink. So I would be an occasional drinker, and it works okay with my personality, I think.
Yeah.
You know, but I think with a lot of golfers, you see that's the big difference with professional golf to maybe when I started out. A lot of professional golfers back when I started out, there would have been substantial. Every day when they finish up the golf, they'd have a couple of pints.
Right.
You know, 3-4 pints in the evening time, that would be seen as normal. You don't see that at all with the young guys, you know. But like all young guys, you know, they're happy enough when they've missed a cut, they'll go out and enjoy themselves. They'll go out in the town. So I think there's a time and a place for everything. That's really what the key is. And for anybody growing up, they have to learn the experience of when the time and the place is. You said yourself there that you don't drink. Well, you learned from experience that you're just not a good drinker. You shouldn't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reality of it. There's loads of people who are angry. There's always, when they drink, there's people who get cantankerous. There's people who fall asleep. There's loads of reasons not to drink. And you have to figure, everybody has to figure it out themselves. It's not a blanket, you know. I certainly don't believe that everybody shouldn't drink. But I certainly believe that everybody should know their own limits and how it affects them.
For sure, you got to figure it out for yourself, but that dispels a myth for me, which is good. Because one of my friends from Galway, I remember after a Ryder Cup that Europe had won and you had won, everyone was going crazy and celebrating. And he told me, he said, "Well, bet on Padraig next week because these guys are all going to be hungover and Padraig's going to be able to play." And you actually did. I think you won the next week or something. So that was. That, but anyway, because he's like, yeah, Padraig was a pioneer. If people don't know what a pioneer is, it's someone who at a younger age takes the pledge not to drink in Ireland. I always find it interesting that he used the word pioneer as if it's like finding the great Wild West or something. But in any event,
I know we're getting off track.
Yeah.
But my father gave up drink.
Yeah.
So just like yourself, Tom, when you ask an Irish person if they've given up drink, there's a good reason why they've had to give it up.
Well, there you
so
go.
So every family in Ireland would have good and bad stories when it comes to drink. It is a very interesting thing.
It is. Irish-American families as well. But going and sticking on your childhood, you went to school, or the same school, which I think is amazing, as Mr. Paul McGinley. Is that true?
That is true.
That's pretty wild school to put out two champion golfers, two Ryder Cup captains. That's amazing.
Yeah, and another European Tour professional, Peter Lowry, went for a year. So we could say that. I would think it was more, not necessarily because his school was good in the sense of we was a middle-class area. We produced a lot of talented people in different arrays of things over the years. So we were the school was right in that sweet spot of kids who wanted to get on and push on. There was at least 6 golf courses in our area. So that really is, it wasn't the school had a golf program or anything like that. We did enter the competitions, but it was more, there's a lot of golf in our area. But when I went to school, you still didn't tell anybody you played golf. You know, I went to school in the 80s in Ireland. Yeah, you kept that to yourself.
Really?
It was only as you... Yeah.
Was that a class thing or a cultural thing? Like, you know, that's like a British game or
class.
Something.
Class. I think it was, if you seemed to play golf, it was seen as a fuddy-duddy game and you weren't tough enough if you were playing golf, I think. So you didn't tell the world about your golf. It was a good school. Like, we had a golf, we entered competitions and certainly in that, but I didn't play with Paul McGinley, as I was saying, because he was 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
But I think it was a lot of good golf courses. And the one thing we had in Ireland, a lot of great competition, very competitive. So there was always levels you could play at, and compete. Even in your own club, when I was growing up, there was like a Saturday, Sunday competition, a Wednesday competition, and often another competition during the week. So you, even in like a 15 handicapper, would be playing four competitions a week.
Yep.
So lots of competition.
I found that to be the huge difference in the golf that I've played around Ireland and Scotland, is that there's always like a medal on or there's something being played. And I accidentally, when I show up, I accidentally get in one, you know, like that there's this competitive drive. And that is, I think, a big difference between golf here versus golf there. You know, at my club, we'll have club championship and like member, guest, and member, member. And that's kind of it. I mean, there's other things you can do, but in terms of like having to like post a score and turn in a card, you find that all over Irish golf courses. And then, of course, you know, the North and South and West and East championships, and there is such a competitive thing. I mean, do you think that explains? I'm curious how Ireland has cranked out so many, a country, you know, geographically the size of, say, Indiana, with a population of, you know, 4 to 5 million, et cetera. So many major champions, so many great golfers. I don't need to go through the list. You're certainly on it. You think that's one of the reasons why?
Absolutely. 6 million of us now, north and south.
6 million.
So we're getting big, yeah. I think we peaked at 10 million at the start of the famine, so we haven't got back that far yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're 100% right about competition. So when I was growing up at school age, once I got to Irish level, I could go to any of my local golf clubs and play for free.
Really?
So I have never paid a green fee in my life. So every game of golf I've ever played, because I'm a pro now, so I'm free. So that's a kind of, it's an unwritten rule, but, you know, the clubs will let. So there was another junior international who played at a local club. So I could go to his golf club and play with him, no green fee. He could come to my golf club, no green fee. And also what made a big difference for us when we played alliances, you know, during the winter, you go to the top clubs and there'd be an entry fee. So the businessman you'd be playing with might be paying 120 euros to play, and they wouldn't charge me the green fee. So I'd just pay the competition fee type thing. So it meant you could play a lot more and play the best golf courses and play the best golf courses with the best players. So it's a good system. I can't understand that in the States, how, you know, difficult it is for players to, how costly it is. Sport in the States is very costly. Golf is cheap in Ireland, relatively cheap. You can make it expensive if you want, but you can make it cheap. My kids that are a member of my local club here, it's 150 euros for the year. That includes lessons on a Sunday.
Wow.
So, you know, it's as cheap as any of the football teams. And equipment-wise, I didn't let my younger son have any golf shoes or any golf equipment. He played in his runners, he played in his trainers and you know, T-shirt and tracksuit until he became interested. You know, you don't have to, you don't have to have the best. Actually, to be honest, you become a better golfer if you don't have the best equipment when you're young. I know that's hard for the young kids to do, you know, but if not having a lob wedge will make them better, not having a full set of clubs will make them better. I played for Junior Ireland when I was 15, and I had to borrow the other half of the set I had off my brother, because we shared a set. And they were actually imitation clubs in the first place that cost £110. So, and I was playing for Ireland. So, you know, mixed bag of clubs. I knew what each club did, and they worked just fine.
That is fantastic. And that's really good advice. I mean, yes, golf over here. Well, because at golf clubs in Ireland, right? I mean, it's... You don't need, a banquet facility. You don't need this, that, and the other. You know, it's a, you know, you've got a maybe a little restaurant, a pro shop, and then golf. And your overhead's completely different. Your maintenance staff is smaller. You know, the expectations of what you have at the country club in America is so expensive. But I found that golf clubs in Ireland and Scotland can kind of keep it simpler and more affordable.
Yes, I would agree with that, but I don't mind the aspirational side of it that you have in the States.
Yeah.
So a young player can start off at the public golf course. I started off playing some pitch and putt as well, which is local little par trees that are you wouldn't even know they were there. Everybody can play, no rules. And if you're getting your kid into golf, I would always say this: if you're getting your kid into golf, bring him somewhere where you're relaxed. Because if you're stressed about bringing your kid somewhere, he'll feel that stress and he won't want to be there. So don't bring your kid out to somewhere that's fussy and has rules. Bring your kid to somewhere that, you know, if they want to roll around the bunker, so what? Let them. If they want to hit two shots and go look in the water and fish for, you know, whatever, let them at it. That's the environment. You want your kid to enjoy the environment. If he enjoys it, he'll find a way of playing good golf. It's easy for kids to learn how to play good golf as long as they're enjoying it. The trouble is you bring them somewhere fussy. There's lots of rules. They can see you're stressed and they just won't want to go back there. So, yeah, I like the aspiration in the States that you can start in the public, move to a better course. And there's always higher and higher levels. That's not a bad thing to have that as long as you still have the public golf courses, which are incredibly important to get the grassroots going.
That's the issue. We need more of that, right?
Yeah. And reasonable members golf courses, because in Ireland they're all members golf courses. They're not a lot of public courses, but they're all members courses, especially for juniors. Not as much when I was growing up. You needed your father to be a member of a golf course up in Dublin to get in. In the country, not so. But now, if you knocked on the door at a golf club in Ireland, certainly if you did it twice and you showed a bit of interest, they'd have a junior program and they'd let you in.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Patrick, you and I have something in common. I try not to. I avoid greens fees as well, but I'm just a freeloader. I don't get it. I haven't earned it at all.
It's an expensive business for somebody. I don't mind.
It is. That's why I'm always begging.
I don't mind the big fees. You see some of the big golf courses in the States because it's a bucket list once in a lifetime. But yeah, if you're going to have to go out there and pay, you know, $200-$300 every time you play around the golf, you know, you'd know about that.
So, you're not going to play a lot of golf, exactly.
Yeah. It definitely makes sense to find your nice, reasonable members golf course, and then to build up a few golfing buddies that you can bring to your golf course, and they can bring you can reciprocate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Your path is a really interesting one. When I was reading up on it, you didn't go right into, you know, it wasn't sort of school, then pro golf. I mean, you actually studied to be an accountant, if I'm correct. And
yes.
even, I think you passed your boards or whatever the Irish equivalent of like a CPA is. So we're weighing whether to go into that or go into golf. Was there a moment? Well, first, do you do your own taxes? Because you're an accountant.
What I learned from studying accountancy for 4.5 years at night is to pay an expert. Okay. It's a complicated business.
Indeed.
I think I started accounting like everybody else. I left what you would call high school at 18 and didn't know what I wanted to do specifically. My brother was an accountant, so he actually physically brought me to the college and enrolled me at night school. Which allowed me play golf during the day. I had no intention of being a professional golfer. Wanted to be involved in the golf industry. I felt an accountancy degree, not that I wanted to be an accountant, would help me, you know, manage a golf course, that sort of, you know, a resort type thing. Didn't really know. This is the 80s in Ireland. I didn't know what was in the world. I really didn't.
Yeah.
You know, like ideally at that stage, I should have been focused. What I would have liked is player management or maybe psychology, sports psychology, those two things. But it just didn't exist in Ireland. And being a professional golfer was not on my radar either. I didn't think I was good enough. And about by the time I got to 21, I'd been playing essentially for 3 years at the top level in Great Britain and Ireland, and I hadn't been beaten in any of the matches. So it was beating the very best that Great Britain and Ireland had had. And they were turning pro. So I was better than the guys who were turning pro. So I said, look, you know what? I'll finish this off, which kept my parents happy. And I felt it was a good backup. You know, when I was studying, I always had golf. And when I was playing golf, I always felt I could always be an accountant. And by the time I was 24, I was ready to turn pro. Started quick, as I said. But I turned pro because I was better than the other guys. When I got to the golf course, I always had a lot of fear. But the fear kind of motivated me and drove me on. And I kept my head down and kept going forward. And I keep saying this to a lot of the young players coming out. We see so many really quality players come at the golf and get lost quickly in professional golf. The ones who survive are the ones who become comfortable in the environment that believe they belong. So it's not a golfing ability, because there's, like, I say this many times, I'll find you 10,000 better ball strikers than are on tour. And I'll find you some guys on tour who are pretty poor ball strikers, but are good golfers. So it's the ones that are comfortable in the environment, believe they belong. So you often get a good player comes out, he gets a couple of starts in an environment he's not used to, you know, course he doesn't know, a lot of pressure on him, and he might miss a cut because of that and feel like he played okay. And, you know, if you miss a cut and you feel you've played well or okay, all of a sudden you think you're miles away from it. And you start always trying to find it and change it and reinvent yourself. And you end up never getting there. Whereas the guys who do nicely get out there, for one reason or another, usually because they get a good start, which I know this, you know, if you get a good start and you make some money your first week, you make a cut, all of a sudden, hey, that doesn't feel too bad. So my first tour event my first tour event as a pro on the tour. So I got an invite, missed a cut in Ireland, went to tour school, got through that, and I played my first event the following year. I got a late invite to the PGA Championship in South Africa, in Durban. I turned up, my clubs were 4 degrees too upright. I got a brand new set of clubs, as you do, new contracts. So I had to grip them on the steel. I got seriously dehydrated on the Wednesday. Now, I mean, seriously, I'm sure in these modern times, I'd be on a drip and whatever. But at a late tee time, so I made it at the tee time. I had a local caddy who didn't talk to me if I hit a bad shot and, like, picked the ball out of the hole and whooped and hollered when I got the ball in the hole. I played horrendous for the week, right? Horrendous. But I chipped and putted like I can chip and putt. I was unbelievable, I'm sure. I took that for granted. Anyway, I finished 46th and I won £1,480. Sorry, I finished 48 and I won £1,460. And I rang my mother, which you do on a payphone back then. I rang my mother. I said, "Mum, you will never believe it. I finished 46th. I played terrible, finished 46th. I won £1,460. They are just giving it away." That's how I felt about it. Because I couldn't play any worse in my head.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how confident I felt that in my bad way, I was still in the money? So the confidence that gave me that, you know, things were only going to get better, which it's an incredible feeling. And I see the opposite happening. Guys turn up, play okay, miss the cut. And that's the nature of professional golf. Doesn't matter. Like, for any normal person, you're going to play well and miss cuts some weeks, and you're going to play average other weeks and be 2 or 3 shots off the lead and scratching your head. How the hell am I nearly winning this tournament? You just, over time, you get used to this feeling. Whereas young rookies, they get lost. So I would say to any rookie, give yourself 2 years where you change nothing. Mm. And at the end of 2 years, you'll at least know where you stand in the greater scheme, whether you do need to change something or whether you're good enough as you are.
That's a gift to have that outlook of being able to say, you know, it's going to get better. And, you know, I played my worst, but I can get there. You know, that's a very winning mentality, but you also, you know, or is that easy to come by, or?
In my case, maybe I would have found it another way, but in some of that, it was circumstantial. I had an okay week scoring wise, even though I felt bad about my game. You know, which just gave me a lot of confidence that my bad was good enough or okay. I think that's, you know, you see it happen. I feel for guys, like I've seen good players, and just circumstantial reasons, you know, some guys get a great start and they think, yeah, I've always destined to be here. And others who are just as good, you know, they're just missing a few cuts and they think, oh, I'm way away. When you're not in professional golf, it's very, very, the margins are very, very slight in professional golf. It was easier in my day. It was, I can guarantee it was easier. Back in the day, there was, you know, the difference between the cut line and doing well in a tournament. Like you can be top 10 and be two shots out of the cut on the PGA Tour. It's very hard for a young kid, if things aren't going well, to feel like they belong and they get lost. And the other thing is, it doesn't matter how good they are coming out. When they get on tour, they're competing against 155 other guys who don't care. They're so busy and they're so working on what they're doing. You know, we've seen it before. We've seen the great guy before. We'll all look over and go, oh, I heard about this guy. Oh, he hits it well. Let's see. And, you know, you can always go back to the Curtis Strange, wasn't it? Curtis Strange commenting on Tiger Woods. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Because that's all we know as professional golfers. We've seen it before. Tiger turned out to be the anomaly and was that star. But we've seen it so many times that every time a good player comes out, pros just shrug their shoulders and go, well, let's see how he gets on. It's not because players aren't caring, but they're so busy doing their own thing. They've seen it before. It's a tough world out in the pro tour to you know, a star from college can easily get left. Whereas somebody like Oberg, the new system probably does help. Mm-hmm. You know, giving cards to the top two players, I think, really does help them assimilate. Remember, a player now knows he come out, he knows he's getting 20-something goes to get his card. That's a lot better a position than a player who comes out and, you know, he's got 7 invites and, you know, if he doesn't act quick, he's probably not going to get the 5th, 6th, and 7th invite type thing. So that's a lot of pressure to handle.
For sure. You mentioned fear as a motivator, and I think fear is a great motivator and being in a healthy motivator. How do you still, at this point in your career, what motivates you? Do you ever still feel fear? You've accomplished so much, but do you still have that advantage of, I think it is advantageous to say that, you know, I'm motivated by being afraid of failure or afraid of whatever, it can push you. Do you get to a point where you're less afraid?
Yes, I think yes. A lot of yeses to your answer there. Fear is a great motivator for a lot of people. So, you know, blindly you would think if you read every book you shouldn't have any, you know, it should be all about dissipating fear. But actual fact, fear can be really, really motivating and very good. I think as you get older in life, and this is where players can burn out, and fear is very intense. And there's no doubt if you could do it a different way, that would be nice. But there's a lot of being great athletes who used fear. As you get older, two things happen. You could either call it burnout or you just get used to it. You lose that fear in a general sense. So I still have fear that I'll hit a bad shot. And it annoys the hell out of me that, you know, you think at this stage that I know not to bail out, but I still do it. You know, I'm worried about hitting the water left. I hit it in the right trees. There you go. Do it all the time. If I could get rid of that fear, I'd be the best player in the world. And so would everybody else be the best player in the world if they could get rid of that one shot fear. The fear I'm kind of talking about is the general fear. Like I start every year for a good 10, 12 years, I come out after my winter break and genuinely be scared that it would be all gone, that somebody, it would just disappear, be taken away. As you get older, you lose that fear that, you know what, if I can't play golf tomorrow, life is still going to go on. I'm still okay. You know, whatever that is, financially or other reasons, I'm doing fine. You lose the aspect of how important you think golf is as you get older. So that's the fear I'm talking about that drove me, that, you know, I'm going to fail. And clearly at this stage of my career, I can't fail. So I don't have that, you know, I don't have that drive. I still have a drive. I still get the fear on individual shots, but I don't have that, you know what, this nearly like my life depends on a fear. So it's a mixed bag. And I said, now I'm motivated for different things. When I go out and tour now, I kind of was burnt out probably 2017, which falls nicely. Nearly every player I know, older players, they basically had 20-year careers. They build up. After about 15 years, they're still playing, but they're not winning the tournaments. They're drifting away. So a lot of people watching wouldn't realize it, but they've gone over the top. At some stage in their career, they'll have two seasons, 18 months, where they play peak. They're never as good after their peak. And nearly every career, probably up to my age, followed that pattern. Everyone, you just pick them all out. They'll have 20 years, two years of peaking. It seems to have changed now with the young guys. They seem to peak early. They seem to have a two-year run pretty early in their career. But they're never as good afterwards. They're just not. So when you hit that height, you're just not going to be the same player. Again, it's whatever it is. And certainly for me, very close to that 20-year window, golf was hard. I was burnt out. And they all get a late win, just like I got a late win. You get one at the end, kind of thrown to you. And what I did basically is I looked at it, I tried a few different things. What about coaching? What about commentary? And I liked doing it. But what I found was, you know what? I still really like playing golf. I like golf. You get to go travel the world. You get to go to great places. The golf courses are in the best condition they possibly can. Who wouldn't want that? So I just figured out what I didn't want involved in the golf. So I don't go at quite the same pace now.
Yeah.
I enjoy myself more at golf tournaments. I look to go to nice places, nice venues. I stay in I basically describe it like 20 years ago, I'd stay at the motel 5 minutes from the golf course rather than the Ritz-Carlton 45 minutes away. That ain't happening now. I'm staying at the nice hotel now. And that's just the way it is. I can't do what I used to do. I do it a different way. Another way of looking at it is, you know, in the main part of my career, for sure, you know, if the lad said we're going for dinner at 8 o'clock, I might have gone, you know what? I've got physio at 7 and I want to get to the gym and I've got to do this, so I'll give it a miss. Whereas now if the lads says we're going for dinner at 8, okay, I'll change my plans. I'm going for dinner at 8. So that would change. That's just how you got to change your life in order. And I think the Champions Tour has been nice with that because that's kind of the attitude you would have. That's what it should be like at this stage. Everybody has kind of done it. You go out there, you hope to play well, but it's not the same stress and pressure. There's no cut for starters. You know, so you can look to enjoy your life a little bit more around the golf, and that then helps you play good golf.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, a hallmark of all those years for you in your career, I think, has been a really extraordinary consistency. You've always been a contender or winning. You've 6 consecutive Ryder Cups. I mean, that's, you know, what do you think the key has been to you for you to that sort of consistency in your golf?
Well, I think we talked about that general fear. I think that really drove me. I think I had, you know, pretty consistently followed. I know, and I knew this before I had my peak of you know, 3 major wins. I think my goal was, I learned this from Phil Mickelson. You know, Phil was the guy who wasn't winning majors back in the day. And every time they asked him about it, he never talked about winning a major. He talked about winning majors. So whenever I was asked about winning a major, I'd say, yeah, I'm going to win majors. I made it plural. So I got very quickly, I won my first one and I was still motivated and I got my second one. I quickly got a third one, but I sometimes wonder, was it in my head 2? I think I had 2 in my head because I didn't want to win 1. Because there's always, any guys who've won 1, winning 1 major is an incredible burden on the player for the rest of his golfing career. It's not a burden when he retires because he won a major. But when he's playing, he's always trying to live up to, was that 1 major lucky? Was that 1 major an outlier. So he's trying to prove himself every day he plays after winning one major. So I had in my goal to win two. I got two, and the third one was, I kind of got in there and grabbed the third one. So I got really quickly. But I'm half thinking that most players end up where they deep down believe, you know, really deep down. Not something I don't know if you can change it. Or at least you have to work on it every day to change it. So like if you've got a goal, you know, whatever your goal is, you'll probably end up getting to it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And if you think of one major, a lot of players have peaked at one major or peaked at making a Ryder Cup team. Clearly I won my three majors in 2007, 2008. What's interesting is statistically I played better golf in 2009, 2010, but I didn't win. And up to 2007, I had 29 second places. I've forgotten third places, fourth places, fifth. Like, people come up and say, you finished fifth in this tournament, and I like shrug my shoulders. Did I? No idea. So like for that period up until I won my majors, I was third in the world, you know, in the days with Phil and Tiger being the top two, and they were well ahead. But like, I had a lot of, as you said, consistent performances right in contention, a lot of high finishes. But once you hit your peak, even though you play great golf, it doesn't seem to happen after that. I think it takes away a bit of that fear. Maybe you're trying to live up to your past expectations. And remember this, every person who's ever won a golf tournament, in their head, when they look back at that, they believe they played great, as in everything they look at it with rose-tinted glasses. They never see a bad shot they hit during the week. But I guarantee you, I certainly know when I look into guys winning tournaments, I see the good breaks they get. I also see the bad breaks they avoid, which nobody can see that. If you know what I mean, it's hard for the player to see that. You might be watching and say, gee, anybody who hit it above the hole here, 3-putt. And that player hits it 6 feet below the hole, taps it in, and he walks off never knowing that that pin was crazy pin. You know, those are the breaks that happen in golf. But every player, when they win, they put themselves up on a pedestal that they can never live up to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you've won a major, you're looking back thinking you don't remember the little tin shot that just carried the bunker and ran up to 12 feet. You know, whereas on your bad week, that little tin bottom groove shot would pitch in the face of the bunker and you're making bogey. They don't, you know, so you're comparing yourself to a completely unrealistic ideal of what you think you did.
Yeah.
And that's hard to live up to. I keep seeing it. You couldn't name me a player that doesn't fit that bracket. You can't name it. They all have to have that period. Like, even Tiger had four majors at one stage. It's just when we all want to peak in golf, but the longer it takes you to peak, the better.
Yeah.
I often wonder with Justin Thomas, he doesn't seem like I know he's just hit a little bit of a bump at the moment, but I've never quite seen him peaking. Like, his majors are spread out, which is quite good. So he actually could still have a peak in him where he goes and wins that two or three majors in a two-year span. But outside of that, pretty much everybody else. Brooks obviously looks like he could break that mold. His five are kind of in an odd space. He looked like he had the 18 months where he could do no wrong in that period.
Mm-hmm.
But getting the fifth one recently really does sort of say that's something to look out for. Jordan Spieth is making a comeback. So he would have fit the mold perfectly. Well, he had it early, but he had that period where he was like unbeatable and then his game was never as good. The fact he's made a comeback shows a lot to his character.
Yeah.
But he's still not the player he was, is he? Like, and you can go much further down the ranks. You can go all the way down to a player, you know, who struggles to keep his card and is all of a sudden a top 50 in the world, a top 50 player who all of a sudden a top 20, or a top 20 who's all of a sudden top 10. But unfortunately, once they hit that high, it just never seems to be the same afterwards.
Well, you're still playing great golf, and I'm interested in knowing how longevity for you. I mean, so playing on the Champions Tour, still showing up in majors and playing very well. What about your longevity? What are you doing to, I mean, and you're hitting it far. I mean, you've probably picked up some speed. I guess you're working with, what's your routine like? What are you working with? Tell me about that, how you're still your own at the young age of 52, still getting it out there.
Yeah, I'm the youngest of five boys. So I think I was brought up a contrarian. I always wanted to have to do something different, always trying to prove people wrong, have an argument. And I think I'm so fascinated with golf. I want to be different. I want to prove everybody wrong and do it, you know, do something that nobody else has done. I think that's a big part of my motivation. I like playing golf. I figured that out. I think that's very important. I think players, they hit a wall. And I think business people, you come across these people who want to retire. So they've been very successful in their business and, you know, they're financially secure, you know, maybe at 50 years of age, but they're hitting the wall in business. And they think, oh, well, I'm going to give this up and do something else. You'll never be as good at that something else. Mm-hmm. Clearly, if you're successful at one thing, it's very rare for you. You can get okay at the other thing. It's like ex-sports people thinking they're going to play golf competitively. And you go, well, you're never going to be a pro. You can be quite good, but you've missed all that early learning and experience that they just never pick it up. They can be good physically, but they'll never have that mental, the little bit of mental that you just learn with experience from being around the game. So I say to those business people, you know, what you've got to do is you've got to sit down and find out what really you're not enjoying about your business, about your work, what you're doing. Because you're an expert in that field, but there's something that's not helping. And get rid of it. Just don't do that bit. Whatever that bit is, you've got to get... That's what retirement or changing is. Get rid of the stuff that you don't like and stick with the stuff that you're good at and you do like. And I think that with golf, very much, I got to a stage that, you know, I just couldn't keep up the pace. What made me successful, you know, when I was winning majors, I can't keep doing that. I can't work out 2 hours a day, two and a half. I don't, you know, back in those days, I didn't eat red meat at night for years. I didn't have a burger for years. I didn't eat French fries for years. You know, I was disciplined with my diet. Not a chance now. I'm there to enjoy myself. You know, I'm not out there. You know, I've done all my hard work. I see the guys working out in the gym. I work out in the gym. Still like working out in the gym. And I see the guys going in there and they're really disciplined. You know, they're doing all the fine movement stuff, the really, really hard and boring stuff. And I'm just sitting there going, I'm not doing that. I'm quite happy to go in there and pick a heavy weight up and lift it and exert myself. But I ain't doing the fine little core work and all those little... No. I did that. That was me years ago. I was that soldier, not anymore. So, you know, you just got to find a new outlook. The speed definitely, I don't know if it's unique to me, but I can't play golf. I couldn't go out and play golf as a short hitter, no matter how good I was. So if you put me out in a tournament and there was a par five that the fields or the top few in the field were reaching and I wasn't one of them, I just couldn't compete. I just would feel like, oh, no, that I'm giving up too much. It would. So if I wasn't keeping my speed up, it would hurt me all the way through my game. There's plenty of players who are not like that, but it would bother me. If I'm standing there hitting having to hit a 5-iron to a tight pin over a bunker and the guy on the par tree is hitting 6-iron, that would bother me. Because I was never in that situation in my career. So I needed the speed. So look, very simple. I try everything. You know, I do think I use the super speed sticks. They're great. They fire me up. They're actually quite good for me because I'm away and I can come home and I can kind of hit a session and bump myself up again. You know, it refreshes things. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm away playing tournaments and this is what people have to get around their heads, you've got to actually swing harder on the golf course. So, you know, even if you go to the gym and get stronger, if you don't swing harder on the golf course, that strength ain't going to come in. You actually have to swing harder. So basically, and again, coming back to the super speed sticks, what they train you to do is to move faster without the inhibition of where's the golf ball going. Mm-hmm. Because we all have this fear of hitting it offline, and that curtails us. So most of us were curtailed by a fear, a psychological limit that we put on our speed. Most of us. It's not we can't swing harder or faster. It's we don't want to swing harder or faster. You might even notice deep down you don't want to do it because you've got a fear of missing.
Yeah.
So ultimately, you know, I said super speed is brilliant for that you don't have a ball. You know, but I've used impact bags. I've used a number of other training devices, but I think once you've done it, you've got to stand there. You know, hit 20 balls a week. Is that a lot to ask for? 20, 40 balls a week on the range where you actually give up on accuracy and just stand there, and your only goal is to swing as hard as you can. So I do that more often now, especially when I'm playing with my friends. I go out there and I am jumping out of my boots when I'm playing a practice round with my friends. And oftentimes they look at me and go, you know, gee whiz, you hit a wild one. And it doesn't bother me because I'm actually got straighter on the golf course, because the goal with all these speed things is it's not to swing out of your boots on the golf course. It's to be able to swing within yourself at a golf course at a higher level.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are great tips. You have great tips all over YouTube if anyone watches Patty's golf tips, and you all should. I've been watching them, really enjoying them. I mean, you're preaching common sense. You're preaching great ideas, and also some contrarian, some different ideas. that I was watching the do's and don'ts today. Don't keep your head down. Don't flex your knees. Why shouldn't I keep my head down? Everyone says keep your head down.
Oh, it's unathletic. Why right. would you constrain anything? Like I'm not telling you you don't keep an eye on the golf ball, but you'll hurt your head. You'll hurt your neck if you try and keep it down too much. I'm a great believer in let your head do what it naturally does for you, which you would if you were swinging a baseball or swinging a bat at a ball. You wouldn't think of keeping your head locked and constrained. You keep an eye on the ball, which your head will do nice rotation. So really one of the worst thing an amateur can do is keep their head down. And to be honest, if you put it down, it's more likely to pop up. So that's
a good point.
Yeah. Whereas we've seen now, I have another video out there, up, down, up. And we're seeing that amateurs, if you actually want them not to top the ball, like beginners, tell them to go up in the backswing. Because if they go up in the backswing, they're going to have to come down. And down, then that means and you still want them up again at impact, but that means if they've gone up and the down, that means they'll be much later into the downswing before they come up again, which means they'll hit the ball. Whereas an amateur who tops the ball, generally a beginner, they go down in the backswing. So the first move of the downswing is straight up, which is a top. So we want to delay that. We want the up because that's speed. So up, down, up is... So next time you see an amateur top a ball, tell them to lift up in the backswing.
Okay.
See, because they'll have to come down.
I love it.
So it's a much better way of doing it. But there's a lot of things. I play pro-ams every week. I see it all the time. I see the constant same things. And each person is in a certain category. You come along and you see whether they're a beginner or whether they're an ex-player. And we can tell. I can tell most players by how they walk up onto the tee what they're going to be like. Certainly, there's a lot of similarities and falls in each category. And I love telling people. I think I broke my wrist a few years ago, 2019, and I went over to play the Florida Swing on the PGA Tour, and it was actually still injured. So I spent about 3 weeks at the Bears Club. Jack kindly let me hang out and try and rehab. I could do some chipping and that. And I joked by the end of 3 weeks, you know, if a member lifted their head and made eye contact, they were getting a lesson. That was it. if they even looked in my direction, they were getting a golf lesson. I love telling people, you know, something they're doing that they didn't know with golf. And golf seems to be the greatest sport in the world for if we all did the opposite of what we thought, we'd be much better off. So that yeah. And it's the hardest thing in the world. Like I just said, to keep your head down in the swing, you need to lift up. It always seems to be the opposite. To hit the ball right, you need to swing left. To hit it left, you need to swing right. It's a crazy game for
right.
the opposite. So it's a great game when you start talking to people, and especially if they're struggling with a certain area of the game, that you give them a few ideas. And generally, I hope I'm trying to give quick fixes. Mm-hmm. And I often say this to people, like if you came up to me and asked me for a 40-yard bunker shot, I'd love you to ask me for a 40-yard bunker cut, because I'd say straight out to you, you're way too far ahead. If that's what's worrying you is 40-yard bunker shots, you're way, way ahead of the game. Okay, you need to go and see a PGA pro and get yourself consistent lessons. Paddy's Golf Tips is about getting you to that point, that the last thing you're worried about is your 40-yard bunker shot. So I'm just trying to get the weekend warrior enjoying the game, getting going, having fun, at least going on the right track. So like if I put this up, if I'm teaching a beginner, it's very straightforward. You learn to swing the club athletically by moving and swing it as fast as you can. Okay, that's number one. So you swing that stick as hard as you can for probably 2-3 months. I don't care if you fresh air everything for 3 months. Swing it as hard as you can with plenty of movement in your feet and body. You need to find out where the ground is. So number two, you've got to be able to bang the club off the ground. So you've got to know where that club is bottoming out. So you're all consistently hitting the sole plate off the ground. You've got to know that. So find the ground. And the third thing, which I think is quite startling now, the third thing is you've got to know where the club face is. The amount of amateurs who are playing this game for a long period of time have no idea really where their club face is. So whether it's square or not square. So the way to figure out where your club face, how to understand what the difference between the club being a couple of degrees open and a couple of degrees closed, is actually practice hitting one shot with it incredibly closed. So you hit the biggest hook you can, and then hit the next shot with it incredibly open. That's how you learn how to hit a straight shot. You hit the two opposite ones and then start bringing it in. Rather than everybody tries to hit a straight shot and they end up not really knowing which one, where the club face is and what's exactly happening. So I would say hook it, slice it, hook it, slice it, hook it, slice it, until you can then start reducing that and have a fair idea of the difference between a hook and a slice. And as I said, those are the three things. That's all you need to learn as a beginner. Those three things. Swing it fast, learn to hit the ground, and then learn to get the club really short at impact and really open at impact. I would like you to have a good grip and good posture, but you probably have that with your, maybe not the grip, that you need maybe a rubber grip to learn that. So that's it. Pretty simple. You've got it all in the thing. Swing fast, hit the ground, learn where the club faces.
I love it. We have this year at the Golfers Journal, we're doing this thing called the Index Experiment, where our members are have chosen different goals for their golf, and we've given them resources to try and help them along their way. And we've seen a lot of handicaps dropping and people improving, and it's been very exciting. So Paddy's Golf Tips on YouTube is a great resource.
I'm going to have to tell you
a lot of wisdom there. Tell me.
So I used to get really frustrated in pro-ams, because I'd get guys and I'd be trying to coach them in the pro-am, and I'm getting annoyed because, I tell them, look, if you spend 20 minutes on your short game, you're going to knock 5 shots off your handicap. Just do this and you're done. And, they wouldn't do it. You could see it. Yeah. They weren't interested. So after a while, I figured out there's two types of people who play golf. There's the person who wants to win a competition, and they're happy to play badly, have a great short game, and get the ball up and down and shoot a good score. They work on getting their handicap down, all that thing. But the vast majority of golfers, and I think it's close to 90%, would prefer to hit the golf ball really well and never win a competition ever again. Maybe the odd competition, the odd once in a while, but they much prefer the feeling, and this is why we love golf, the feeling of hitting a great shot. Yeah. The feeling of swinging the club well and making a good strike. 90% of golfers are in that. They're not competitive. They, winning is a second, completely secondary to swinging the club and hitting the ball well. So, yeah, like you nearly need to identify that with your members, because the guys who are competitive, you know, to get better, all you really need, like, do you know what the difference between chipping a ball over a bunker from 20 yards, 30 yards, 40 yards, and 50 yards is? You know, if you can get the ball on the green, you'd be shocked if you can get the ball on the green from, you know, I was told 150 yards in, I had to get down in three in any way I could. So I ended up just with a great short game because I had to take three. So you learn, you know, you learn the difference between, what's the difference between hitting it from 70 yards and 40 yards and know the difference to your 10-yard gaps and all the little things. Know how to hit a chip and know when to putt from off the green and know when to bump it in the rough rather than, you know, all the little intricacies because you practice it. That's being a competitor. That's being into it. And you know, you want that, but most golfers, they don't. They couldn't care less. They just want to hit one good drive and one good iron shot and make one birdie that's a quality birdie, and they'll talk about that all night.
I know. I don't want to tell you which golfer I've become, I think.
You sound like you're the
I'm chasing not the score. I'm chasing the center of the club face. If I didn't ask you, since your tips have been so good, just very selfishly to give me a tip for an early extender, I kind of stand up and impact. Do you have any, and I know a lot of our members do as well, where your hips and your butt sort of move forward at the ball and you lose those angles. Do you have any tips for that?
Interesting enough, you need to extend in your golf swing. Okay, first and foremost.
Okay.
So your pelvis has to work up.
Right.
So don't be afraid of that. Okay.
Okay. Good.
So there's more to it than
I know,
that.
But so I'm just good with that part.
We want our hips to really accelerate up. That's speed, okay? Yep. So you've gotta have that hip thrust. And I have done a video on Paddy's golf tips with this, but there's a little bit more to it. So a lot of people who early extend, they don't have that pelvis up. They think they do. They're actually trying to stay down so much that their knees stay flexed and come out. Mm. Okay. So I would actually, like I said earlier, I would try get as much as much hip thrust as you can and see what that does for your swing, right? To stop your right knee, because you definitely need your right knee is, you're definitely meant to come up with your right foot and knee, right?
Mm-hmm.
To stop it going out, okay, make sure you have rotation in the foot, okay? So the correct operation of the right foot, you're going to try this the minute you get off this,
oh,
right?
I totally am.
Right?
Yes.
So your right foot is meant to go like you're stamping out a cigarette butt.
And I've done that, so that's handy.
So you squeeze, and it turns, okay?
Okay.
So you watch the best golfers, their heel. So if that was your heel, so I was always brought up to keep my foot going in, but the best swingers, the heel actually comes slightly out. So you're twisting the foot into the ground.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm stamping out the butt
with the ball of your foot.
Exactly, the ball of my foot.
Everybody stamps out a butt with this ball of their foot. Your heel will go backwards, and that will stop the knee from going out. That gives the rotation in the knee, even though your hip is going up. So you won't get as far out because you have a little in. So that might be one, but I would rather you try. I would say to you, try as much hip thrust as you can get. So it maybe go out and hit, say, try 10 shots with really accelerate your hips up.
Mm-hmm.
And it might feel like, oh, I'm getting a little bit behind, that little bit flippy. And then on the 11th one, when you're going to have some of it left in, you try it. And I think you might have a nice balance where you have your hip thrust, but it won't be as exaggerated. And I think that might work nicely for you. So
I'd go
for it. You need hip thrust. I guarantee
love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's just my hips just like go at the ball. You know, I need them to go around. I need them to move.
If you were thinking about you might say you want your hip thrust to go towards the target.
Right, right, right.
But don't, you do need that your hips to come up.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the speed comes. So, but I think a little bit of rotation in your right leg the internal rotation would help with that, not getting too far ahead of you.
Done. Thank you. So that's a lifesaver.
Paddy, I have to say, I posted a video recently on Paddy's Golf Tips, and it was only a week or two ago. It's one of my most popular ones for feedback coming back to me on the golf course. You know, people would come up and say, because I used a quote in it, and I'm going to use it to you.
Do it.
In the downswing, you've got to squeeze your bollocks. So that will get your hip thrust up without going forward. You squeeze. So your legs are fighting each other. You squeeze in, and that lifts them up. Okay? You understand it, Tom, because you're Irish. Your readers might know what the bollocks is.
Well, that's what Google's for, to find out about the bollocks.
Yeah.
And how to effectively squeeze them in your golf swing.
Yeah.
It does make sense, and it's not a tip that you'll soon forget. Love that. Paddy, we're going to Ireland. The Golfer's Journal is going to Ireland this summer. We're going from Rosspenna down to Ballybunion and everything in between. Just want to get your favorite. Give me your top five favorite Irish links, and hopefully we're going to some of them.
I give you a couple of sections. You're doing the West Coast, Northwest Coast.
Yep.
I would suggest you're really looking at that's rugged Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So for people coming over, you know, there's a lot of walks, and you know, it's a bit more harsh, the land. It's a bit more, I think it's a bit more what people will expect of Ireland, the Northwest.
I agree.
You get down to the Southwest, that's where a lot of tourism is. It's very luxurious. You know, it's much, I'm not saying higher end, but it's certainly the land is much more fertile, and everything that goes with it is just more beautiful. Okay. Laid out for tourism, you know, beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You come up to Dublin. Dublin is the city. There's a bit of tourism, but if you want to come to Dublin, you don't have to be a tourist in Dublin. So there's some great golf in Dublin and the East Coast. You can you can stay in Dublin and play golf around Dublin, in Dublin. Fabulous. But you're not necessarily, you can be a tourist if you want, but you can certainly come to Dublin and just be enjoying a big city anywhere in the world. You can obviously do the north, spectacular golf courses up the north coast. Royport Rush being one of my favorites, absolutely. So you know, there's four different sections of the country you can go and play. So my favorites: Royport Rush, Portmarnock, Ballybunion. Not necessarily in that order, but they're my top three. Outside of that, I'd start naming sections, you know, golf courses. You know, if you come to Dublin, you should play the Island, mm-hmm. Royal Dublin, Portmarnock. Both Portmarnock's great, County Loud, European Club. I would venture and go play the K Club. Ryder Cup was there. They've upgraded it in the last couple of years. It really is worth going to play it. It's stadium. It's where I practice a lot. It's mm-hmm. a real good professional golf course. If you go to North, you know, you're going to do Royal County Down, and you're going to do Port Rush for sure. Port Stewart is beautiful, and you kind of would move across. I think, you know, you either go County Loud up there, you move across, and you go play the Rosspenna and start coming down. You know, great courses, obviously Sligo, Connemara, some great courses on the west coast there. And then you get further down. Once you get down south, you know, you are looking at your Waterville's, your Lahinch's, your Ballybunion's, you know, the typical ones, I think, that are known. If you're really into, you know, five-star treatment, you know, Adair Manor.
Sure.
You know, I can say to my wife, I'm going playing golf, and this hopefully some of your listeners will understand this. I can say to my wife, I'm going playing golf. My wife will just, yeah, fine. I can go and say I'm playing golf in Adair, and she says, I'm coming. So, you know, exactly. it's a five-star resort, yeah. And if you bring your wife with you, you'll be welcome to come back to Ireland and play golf any time in your life by your wife if you bring her there. So that's, you know, and I think when you, there is that in Ireland, I think some people, you can have, You can come to Ireland on a budget. There's other golf courses, links courses, that smaller green fees, low key. You can stay Airbnb. You can do it on a budget. And there is the five star as well. You know, you've got both sides of it. You know, so you might have to work a little bit harder if you're coming on a budget, that's for sure. And then obviously, as I said, you come back up to given the Dublin courses. So yeah, there is a variety. And you know, there's three or four good golf trips in Ireland. You don't have to. I will say to anybody listening, don't think you can travel the whole of the country. It takes a long time to travel from one place to the other in Ireland. So, you know, I don't think you're better off going to one area and playing the golf courses in that area and staying there and maybe having a base and traveling out from it. Having, you know, if you've got a group, you have somebody else drive you so you can relax when you're going back to your base. You know, trying to get in a car and play every day a different golf course, it can be tough. You don't get to enjoy going out and having a meal and a few drinks in the local pubs where the entertainment. So I definitely believe, or if anything, when visitors come, they overdo the schedule a little bit. Have some day off or break and have a little bit of, you know, just, you know, it, what looks tiny on the map takes a long time in Ireland. So get yourself a driver for the van and you can have a few beers and you go back to your hotel or something like that. It's one of those things. Thinking you can do it on your own can just make it a stressful week.
I know that very well. Ireland is much bigger than it looks on the map. I learned that lesson when I tried to walk around the place. So no doubt about it. Todrick, I can't thank you enough for your time and your insights and helping our reader, our listeners and readers out with some great tips. I hope when we're over there, and we're going to be over there for around in June, we're playing 54 holes at Ballybunion on the summer solstice. So yeah, exactly. You should come, hopefully, come over and join us. You'll probably be golfing somewhere in the world, but hope our paths cross when we're over there.
Hopefully so. Look forward to it, Tom.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, we strongly encourage you to become a member of the Golfer's Journal, or if you already are, to share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without you. We also couldn't do it without the help of our partners, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, Linksoul, Omega, Charles Schwab, and BMW. We'll see you next time on the Golfer's Journal podcast.